We're starting this new paragraph in Galatians 5, starting in verse 7. We spent several weeks looking at the basic issues of this section as Paul addressed them in the first 6 verses. We've said many times that chapters 5 and 6 are the application of the truth of justification by grace through faith that is developed in detail in chapters 3 and 4. There is a life that is supposed to flow naturally out of that, but it can't flow naturally until those issues are established clearly. So in chapter 5, Paul zeroed in on those issues. He talked about the things that can keep us from being able to walk properly because of the tendency that human beings have of inserting their own performance issues into the whole mix of their relationship with God. And that typically just does not work. In Christ Jesus, according to verse 6, circumcision is used as a single word summary of a whole theological construct, and uncircumcision is used as a single word summary of a whole construct that's the opposite. And that entire continuum from the circumcision all the way to the uncircumcision cannot accomplish God's purpose in anybody's life. It will not work. Those concepts are fundamentally flawed, and therefore anybody that tries to use them for life's purposes will fail utterly. But there is a methodology that does work at the end of verse 6, faith. A faith that is energized by the kinds of priorities that God's love establishes as true values, things that are really valuable. So that's where we have been, and what we're going to be doing this evening is beginning in verse 7 down through verse 12, talking about Paul's reminiscing about them in relation to what was happening in the past and what's going on right now. He says in verse 7, you were running well. And then he raised the question, who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion did not come from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And then he, for the first time in the book, he actually declares that I have confidence in you and the Lord that you will adopt no other view. Up until this point, he's been a little bit ambivalent about where they were and whether or not they would adopt his view. But by this time in chapter 5, verse 10, he apparently has, in fact, the terminology of verse 10 is, I have been persuaded by the Lord. So apparently God's Spirit working in his mind and heart as he writes this letter to them has brought him to a conclusion by the time he gets to verse 10 in chapter 5 that these Galatians are, in fact, genuine, born-again children of God who are being subjected to false brethren. And their confidence in the truth has been waylaid to some degree, but his letter will correct that. That's the declaration. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to take verses 7 and 8 and work backwards. The issue of the focus of the application of the truth of justification by grace through faith to the processes of actually living. I believe myself that the doctrine of justification by grace through faith is a microcosm doctrine that is supposed to be unpackaged in life on a daily basis so that sanctification is by grace through faith exactly the same way justification is, with this difference. It only takes one act of legitimate faith to get God to justify you. But your life has to be a multiple decisions of trust through the days. The process is not different. It's just that you have to learn how to apply it more regularly, more consistently. It's not a one-time done deal kind of thing like justification is, unfortunately. We would all like to be able to make one decision. It would carry us through life and be done with it. But that's not how it works. So he's taking the doctrine of justification by grace through faith in chapters 3 and 4, and now he's expanding it into the area of how we're supposed to live day by day by day. And he starts out in verse 7 by saying, you used to do this well. You were running well, but you've been hindered. Who's done this? And then he says in verse 8, this persuasion doesn't come from him who calls you. So that's where we're going to start with the issues of the stair-step kind of thing. What's happened here? Who hindered you? What has happened? And in my thinking, verse 8 gives the preliminary things that got them going correctly in verse 7. In other words, they were running well because of some things that are revealed in verse 8. So the most fundamental issue of living effectively starts with Paul's concepts of verse 8, the calling of God. He says, this persuasion did not come from him who calls you. So the first thing about living is this issue of the call of God. God's summons to these people, just like his summons to you and me, is the foundation for a persuasion that enables us to run well. And there is a flaw in our perception of the calling when we are hindered by false information and are derailed or run off the track in our running. And it fundamentally implies that our perception of the calling is slipping. That's the issue in verse 8. I went back through the book of Galatians to look at this issue of God's calling. And if we look quickly at Paul's focus on the issue of calling in Galatians, it highlights a central issue. If you go all the way back to chapter 1, where in verse 6, immediately after his introduction, he says, I'm amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ. They translate in New American Standard, by the grace of Christ. But God called them into this grace of Christ. And they are now departing from him who called them into that. So the calling in chapter 1, verse 6 is deliberately tied to grace. You are summoned into grace. And then in chapter 1, verse 15, in his own personal testimony, he says, when he who had set me apart, even from my mother's womb, and called me through his grace, was pleased to reveal his son in me, so on. The issue here is that Paul's participation in life had two elements. One was his physical birth, being separated from his mother's womb, and the other was his spiritual birth, where he got clued into the truth. And that spiritual birth is referred to as being called through God's grace. So again, the calling and grace are tied very closely together. The other reference in Galatians besides verse 8 of chapter 5 is verse 13 of chapter 5. And in verse 13, which is in the very next paragraph, it says, for you were called to freedom, brethren. So here he doesn't directly refer to the issue of grace, but when you go back to verse 1 of chapter 5, it was for freedom that Christ set us free. You've been called to freedom, verse 13. The issue there is that the summons was for the freedom that Christ made his objective for your calling. He called you to freedom. But freedom is tied up with, according to verses 2 through 6, your perception of the grace. So all the way through Galatians, Paul's concept of the summons that God issues is a summons to come to grace, to come into a relationship that's rooted in grace, as opposed to a relationship that's rooted in some other issues. In the book of Galatians, the other issues are legal. God is flat not interested in a judicial relationship with his children. He doesn't care about being their judge, and he doesn't want them relating to him out of a sense of necessity driven by the fear of condemnation. And that's what a legal relationship does. It can't help it. The law levies a heavy penalty on failure, and nobody can survive under the law with that heavy penalty for failure thing without one of two things happening. They either go into blind pride where they don't think they failed, or they go into hopeless despair where all they can see is their failure. And in neither one of those cases will a relationship with God fly. It just won't work. So God's summons, whether you're Jew or Gentile, is a summons away from any kind of legal relationship with Him. He wants a personal relationship rooted in grace. That's the issue. So when He says here that this persuasion did not come from Him who calls you, He's emphatically talking about the issue of whether they've bought into the Abba, Daddy relationship with God that's rooted in not His evaluation and critical perception of your behavior, but on His willingness to continue to work with you regardless of your behavior, in the sense that the only way He can actually effectively transform us is by dealing with the roots of behavior. And the roots of behavior are either a perception of God as a legal judge or a perception of Him as Daddy. And the Daddy thesis that the Holy Spirit was apostolized to create in our hearts is the thesis that gives us the freedom to be the children of God without the fear of the condemnation of a judge. It doesn't give children the freedom to just run over any principles or ignore whatever God the Father says to them, not any more than any legitimate family relationship on the planet. Kids that are just allowed to run smack over anything that they're told not to do or commanded to do by their parents are not being brought up properly, and God is a perfect parent. So He doesn't give us the freedom to just do anything and everything with impunity, but there will never be the application of justice to that. It will always be wise, loving, disciplinary, or encouraging behavior. The view we take of God is the critical issue. That brings us back then in verse 8 to this issue of Paul's just point-blank statement. This persuasion, this buying into a legal relating to God as the foundation for living, this persuasion does not come from the God who called you into His grace. It does not. The problem we have with that is that anybody can say that a certain doctrine is not from God. Anybody can say that. I mean, if you don't like a certain doctrine and somebody's pushing it on you, you can just turn around, that's not from God. That makes it easy for you, because it's not from God. It's kind of like the person who uses the old God told me terminology, because you can't debate that. God told them, well then, do it. But it's a deliberate attempt to leverage your position so that you don't have to deal with any objections. Well, how are the Galatians who are being hindered, how are they supposed to take Paul's declaration that the persuasion that they're buying into that's hindering their former good run, how are they supposed to expect that Paul is correct when he says this is not from God? Because anybody can say that. The problem is validation. Anybody can say something's from God or not from God. I have a friend who told me the other day that God woke him up after several years of his ownership of a piece of equipment that he had bought at a yard sale that he knew when he bought it that the guy had stolen it from his workplace. He told me, God woke me up this morning and told me to take that back. Well, I had the same kind of question he did. Well, why did God wait this long to tell him to take it back? But I don't challenge that. God told you to do something, you better do it. You're not going to get any argument from me on that unless what you tell me that God told you to do is just flat not possible because of what the Bible says. Then I'll say, well, you're not listening to the right God. But he took it back to the company that had been stolen from, and he told the guy that God woke him up and told him to bring this back, and the guy just looked at him and said, well, if God told you to do it, you have to do it, but we're not using that anymore. I mean, so taking it back didn't accomplish anything except that it let him have a clear conscience about something that apparently had been bubbling under the surface for a long time, because I really think probably it was his own awareness that it was stolen property that bugged him more than God waking him up in the morning. But that's just my perception. However, you can't argue with that kind of stuff unless you have some basis for it. And when Paul just comes right out and says, that didn't come from God, how are the Galatians supposed to deal with that? And the only way they can deal with it is to validate whether or not Paul's opinion that this is not from God is a valid opinion. However, in the Galatian situation, it's not that difficult, because Paul took two entire chapters in the beginning of the book, chapters 1 and 2, and he gave those chapters over to a whole host of details that had one intention, and that was to validate his identity as a legitimate apostle from God. If the arguments in chapters 1 and 2 are valid, then you don't have any problem in verse 8 of chapter 5 with Paul saying, that's not from God, and you say, okay. Because if he's a valid apostle, he cannot make that kind of a declaration as an apostle, unless it's true. So the issue of validation in the Galatian situation is not that hard. Anytime the scriptures spend in two entire chapters on something, it's obviously a very important issue and means that it's not going to be simple. God doesn't waste words. Two chapters of inspired revelation about Paul's apostleship and the validation of that apostolic identity, that obviously means that he intends for those two chapters to be the foundation for the rest of the book. And verse 8 is part of the rest of the book. When he says this persuasion didn't come from him who calls you into grace, we're supposed to accept that. But the Galatians clearly were having a real struggle with that. The problem of being hindered, the problem of verse 10, those who are disturbing you, that problem is no small problem in the Galatians' mind. It's a confusion of mind in respect to the facts, and it's a confusion of heart in respect to values, because that's where all confusion comes from. What you value, what you believe. The data, plus your interpretation of that data, and the values that are driving your interaction with that data in the first place. That's always going to be the case, and confusion always arises, either because the thing that is being considered valuable is not, or the thing that's being considered to be true is not. That's the only way you can be confused, is to have somebody tell you something that you have not believed in the past, and it contradicts something that you have believed in the past, and now you're confused. So, we've been dealing with this whole issue through the book, talking about motivation. Why would somebody buy into this when it's clearly not true, according to Paul's words? The interaction between what the data is and what it means and what the values are that are driving that, the issue of verse 6, faith working through love. Faith is believing the data, and love is the driving force. Those issues are connected significantly and problematically, because what a person values is very often buried beneath a host of self-deluding lies. You'll see this in your friends and others that you interact with, where they'll tell you one thing, and in 2 minutes they'll be telling you something else that's completely contradictory, and they will not see the contradiction, you will. And if you challenge it, they'll explain so that it makes sense to you. They'll try to. And the reason is because we have these enormously potent desires for things that we consider to be valuable. And we have this strong, potent desire for the things that we've said are true to be true. And so when somebody challenges our values and our beliefs, we don't willingly go with them. We resist to some degree. And part of that resistance is we don't know what we hold as truly valuable much of the time. I'm personally convinced that that's the reason why our lives run the way they do. If we will listen to our emotional reactions to the things that are happening in our lives, we will be able to detect what it is that we're holding as valuable. Because when you are instantly made afraid of something, that fear is telling you that something that you hold as valuable is being threatened. And it's not a hard thing to figure out what that is, if you're willing to listen. So there's an interaction between the facts and the values. And there is this blindness of the heart that shows up because we know the Bible says I shouldn't value this, but we value it. So we say we don't value it, and then we turn right around and we declare that we do in the way we act. So what a person values is often buried, and it's a difficult thing for us sometimes to discover what we've buried and why we've buried it. Because we don't want that to be challenged, to be revealed as an invalid thing. The other reality, though, is that what a person values is far more crucial to understanding than any other element. You will believe what you want to believe, because what you want to believe will reinforce the legitimacy of your values. If somebody tells you that that's not important, you shouldn't be wasting your time pursuing that, but you spent your whole life pursuing that, you're going to have all kinds of things that are going to justify your pursuit of that. So you'll start bringing out your arguments, and every one of them will be what you consider to be facts, but they will be reinforcing the legitimacy of your value. And your friend or whoever confronts you may not hold that as valuable and won't believe any of those arguments because he sees them as just justifying your desires. Well, that's just part of the human condition. We want what we value to be important to God. In fact, we actually act like it is. If I like it, God's got to like it. That kind of thing. You see this a lot in the, and I don't want to get off on music, but a lot of the choice of musical stuff in church is not biblically driven. It's desire driven. I like this kind of music, and since I like it, God obviously likes it. And if God likes it, then we can use it to worship Him. And, you know, it has nothing to do with anything the Bible might have said about that kind of thing. So that's just one illustration of how our values are so crucial. That's why the book of Proverbs says, guard your heart, that's where your values are, with all diligence, because out of that comes the issues of life. Now, in Paul's dealings in Galatia, as he writes the letter to the Galatians, he really doesn't do much with the values thing, because he has no control over that. What he does is he puts the facts out there. He pushes the facts because he knows he cannot make the heart value what's valuable. He can't do that. But he can challenge the mind about the facts. And that's what he did in chapters 1 and 2. He said, if you don't believe that I'm a legitimate apostle, deal with this. Fact number 1, fact number 2, fact number 3, fact number 4. All of them verifiable. None of them deniable. And that's where a lot of the heat in arguments come from, is when somebody realizes that they can't deny it, they can't refute it, and it makes them mad because they got to refute it in order to be able to continue to go down the path they're going. So that's what Paul's doing in Galatians. He's laying these facts out. And I'm sure that some of the Galatians were put out with him when he started out chapter 3. You fools, what are you doing? And then telling those that are wanting to be justified by law that if they receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to them whatsoever. I'm sure that upset them because they had an agenda that's in their values. The thing that I want us to focus on, though, is the only way we can ever be delivered from our own self-imposed blindness to our values is dealing with the facts. And the most critical fact in the book of Galatians is that the only way God can effectively deal with sinners is by grace, if, in fact, the redemption of sinners is to be accomplished. God can deal with sinners on the basis of justice if He chooses to, and they will perish. If that's what God wants to do, that's what will happen. But He'll never develop a personal relationship of life, sharing His life with somebody that is perishing. That won't happen. They've got to be drawn out of that whole mindset in order for life to be theirs as a participating reality with Him. The only thing that can drive that in the character of God is the grace of God. There is no other way to deal with sinners beneficially. Grace is the only way. Now, the most critical element in the concept of grace is its total divorce from human performance issues. Total. If you buy into any legal principle as a part of your relationship with God, you will fail at the level of verse 9, which we'll come back to next week. A little leaven, the whole loaf will be leavened. You let the concept of a legal issue come into your relationship with God, and before long you'll be a full-blown legalist. And you'll have no relationship. Oh, you'll think you do, just like the Pharisees thought they did. But the fact is, grace is the only effective, beneficial way God can deal with sinners. And the critical element of grace is, Romans 11, if it is by works, it is no more of grace. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. So you got to get this whole thing out of your mind that God is going to deal with you according to the way you act in the issue of justice, because He's not. He's going to deal with you as a daddy. And it may look like justice on occasion, but never will be. You can survive a legitimate application of justice in any area of your life. You couldn't survive it. The justice of God is a burning fire. It would destroy you. And Abba doesn't want to do that to His children. So, the real solution to the issue of the call of God and whether Paul's statement is legitimate that this persuasion is not coming from God, the bottom line here is going to be a ruthless consistency in application of logical progression. Now, I realize you can't depend on your logic in the final sense because we are fully capable of being irrational. But logic is simply a legitimate way of thinking. If you can think from one point to the next one, to the next one, to the next one, to the next one, and keep the tie, keep the logic in there so that people can't say, oh, well, but you're overlooking this, which would change your connection here. If they can't do that to you, then you're on track. That's the only basis we have for any hope that life will get any better. I'm convinced that the exegetical and expository study of the scriptures, verse by verse by verse by verse by verse, actually applies that reality because the verses are logically, inherently consistent with themselves and with their context. And the more you consider words in their context, the more you're pushed to begin to believe the things that those words are saying. And the more you're pushed, the more you are brought to awareness that your values may be misplaced. So, ruthless, logical consistency is the only way that the call of God can be recognized as a legitimate thing. In the text, there is another level. The one who calls you into His grace does that in order to persuade you of some things. And verse 8 says, this persuasion does not come from Him who calls you into His grace. So there is a persuasion that he does use, that does come from him who calls you. So that means that persuasion is the next level issue. The call of God is first. God utters a summons. He summons you some way, some form. Some people's experience is more radical or unique, like Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus. I mean, that was pretty potent. Others of us just kind of get a little something and it becomes the summons of God to us. When I think about the day that I believed the gospel, when I think back over my history, there were two preliminary actions that God did that stick in my mind. Now, I know there were dozens and maybe thousands of things that God did, but the two things that stick in my mind were those preliminary preparation things. One of them was the recognition that I was probably going to go to hell when I died. And I remember telling God, sitting on the back pew of the Methodist Church in Combs, I don't want to go to hell when I die. And why that sticks in my mind, I have no idea, but it's there. I knew, even though that church probably didn't teach that I was going to go to hell when I died. I don't know what they taught. I didn't pay any attention. But anyway, I knew I was going to go to hell when I died, and I told God I didn't want to. And I was a younger kid at that time. The next thing that sticks in my mind is the day I dragged the boy out of the surf at Padre Island who drowned in my presence. It was his graduation party that we were celebrating, his graduation from high school, and he drowned. And his girlfriend was the one who was struggling to get him back to the beach, and I got out there to where she was to help her because she was exhausted. And I remember just as clear as a bell thinking, God, you just got to do something. This guy's dead. I'll do anything you want me to do if you'll just make him live. And I didn't realize you can't bargain with God. And he didn't live. I mean, they had his funeral. But those two things made me aware in a subconscious way that if you're going to go to hell when you die, and death is this real, you really need a solution. I didn't reason that out. It was just there. So when I heard the gospel, the promise of eternal life based on faith in what Jesus did, faith in it was just the next thing to do. That was the persuasion. Well, I think that God was calling me by grace. He was the one who was messing with my mind and making me think about these things. But at the same time, he was preparing me to receive a persuasion that was from him, and it was a summons into grace. So persuasion's a big deal. Paul says this persuasion doesn't come from him, but there is a persuasion that does. And when you were responding to the persuasion that does, you were running well. That's what verse 7 says. In a cause and effect universe, it's really crucial that we understand each progression because this cause produces this effect and then this effect becomes the cause for the next one. In other words, every effect becomes the cause for the next effect. And you're just going up this ladder, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. But each cause produces its effect and each effect becomes the next cause that produces its effect and so up you go. Well, in that reality of a cause and effect universe, you really do need to understand each level. Because if you go up to here in this cause and effect thing, and you make this the issue, and it's several steps removed from the beginning, you're going to create a false perception of the way things are. It'll inevitably lead you to error. And then it'll just pile more error on top of it. That's what the Jews did. The Jews took the giving of the law when they skipped all these lower steps and they turned the law into a way in which they could qualify themselves for acceptance by God. That was not the reason God gave the law. It was a misperception because they skipped all this stuff And because they perceived it that way, everything after that was an error. And they just stacked legal doctrines on top of each other until they either got so proud that they couldn't even see past their ego, or they got so depressed that they became tax gatherers for Rome or some such thing. Because that's all you can do in the face of the law. You either get proud or you get despairing. In my experience of listening and watching and seeing what's going on, I think the most frequently found displacement, the jumping to a making this foundational when it's actually several steps off the bottom, I think the most frequently displacement is jumping over these basic things to get to obedience. Most preachers have an agenda in their preaching, and they recognize that if they have to wait on people to understand all of this other stuff, they'll never get this done. So they just skip all this stuff and preach the obedience requirement. You know, if you want to build a big building, you've got to deal with people giving. That's the only way you'll be able to build it. Well, if you have to start down here in terms of whether people are going to share with your agenda any of their financial stuff, if you've got to start down here, it'll be several years before they get the freedom of giving to your agenda. And if you don't have several years to wait, you're not going to wait. You'll just jump clear over here and you'll go immediately to Malachi and preach storehouse giving. And you'll just completely ignore the fact that God is not pleased with anything that's given that can't be given freely out of a heart that just wants to do it. So, in the Christian world, what you end up having is a whole host of people who are emphasizing obedience, obedience, obedience. Just do it. Well, obedience is not the top rung. It's not even in the middle of the thing. What you value is more crucial than your obedience. What you believe is more crucial than your obedience. But what you value and what you believe will produce the behavior that will be called either obedience or not. It's persuasion based. And that's why I have a real problem with verse 7 in the translation, "You were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth?" The translators jump to obedience with no justification. The word that's translated obedience is used by Paul in Galatians. And I want you to look at chapter 1, verse 10, where it's used by Paul. "Am I now seeking the favor of men or of God, or am I striving to please men? If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a servant of Christ." Where is our word that should be translated obedience? It's not found in the English translation because obedience wouldn't make any sense in this verse. But the word is there. And so they don't translate obedience there because obedience won't work there. If you go to chapter 5, verse 10, where he says, "I have confidence in you in the Lord that you will adopt no other view, for the one who is disturbing you will bear his judgment, whoever he is." Where is obedience there? Well, obedience won't work there, so they don't try to translate the word that Paul used in verse 7 as obedience. The word is persuasion. The only other place where you have this phrase, obeying the truth, is in chapter 3, verse 1. "You foolish Galatians." No, verse... Well, maybe it's in the King James of chapter 3, verse 1. How does that read in the King James? Do you have it, Kelly? Because I think in the King James it says, "Who has bewitched you from obeying the truth?" that you should not obey the truth. The New American Standard, obviously, the editors didn't feel like that had sufficient textual basis for being in there. But the fact is, the King James translators translate that obeying the truth. Well, that's exactly Paul's phrase in chapter 5, verse 7. And there's no compelling reason to translate it obedience. Because the word means to be convinced of something, to be persuaded. In fact, the verb in verse 7 that's translated obeying is the verbal form of the noun in verse 8, this persuasion. So my point is this. There is a legitimate process that brings out the kind of behavior that you want from somebody. But that legitimate process is getting them to value what's valuable, getting them to believe what's true, and once they're convinced of the value of the thing and the truthfulness of the facts, they will automatically begin to behave in a way that's consistent with the thing they love and the thing they believe. You can't help it. I've said this over and over. The woman who went after the hem of his garment that had the issue of blood for 12 years was terrified. She was fearful. And it only increased when she touched his garment and was made whole. And Jesus said, "Who touched me?" She tried to slink back into the crowd and disappear. She was scared spitless. But that didn't keep her from doing what she believed. That's the power of believing. When you believe something, it motivates your behavior, even if it has to run roughshod over the things you're scared of. Faith does that. Faith is a grain of mustard seed, will run over your fears. It won't keep you from being afraid, but it'll still motivate your behavior in spite of your fear. So, in the biblical operation, you need to challenge what a person values. You need to challenge the facts that he claims he believes. And then, if you can get him to value what's valuable and believe what's true, you won't have to worry about his obedience. It'll just automatically be there. And that's why Paul said in verse 7, "You were running well. Who hindered you from being persuaded regarding the truth?" It's not obeying. He's not worried about their obeying. He's worried about what they have been persuaded to believe. And then he says, this persuasion, this thing that you've bought into, it didn't come from the God who called you. So both verses are not dealing with behavior issues, obedience issues. They're dealing with a step down below that. And that's why I say in the cause-effect universe, you don't dare jump up too high to start. You need to start where the beginning is. That's why Genesis 1 is in Genesis 1. The point that I'm trying to make here is that Paul had a specific methodology. It starts with the calling of God, who can address what you value, and he can address the facts that he makes you think about. He did that to Paul, and he does it to every one of us that have this calling into grace. That's the beginning. But the next thing is, he's got to persuade you that what he's summoning you to is legitimate. And that's the persuasion. So, obviously, obedience and consequences from behavior, those are important issues. They're deeply involved issues. Paul is writing the book of Galatians because the consequences of their persuasion are clearly heavy duty in terms of what it's going to cost them if they buy into something that's not true. So the consequences and their behavior, they're very critical, but they're not the top level. They're the outworking of some other things. And in this verse, Paul says, there was a time when you understood and you were running well. Who hindered you? Whoever it was brought a persuasion that's not from the God who summoned you into grace. And that tells us very clearly that what's happening here is that they're being persuaded that God is a God of justice who responds to people on the basis of their obedience to his commands. And it's extremely significant that the Jews never really thought of God as daddy. Their theology doesn't allow it. He's the holy, holy, holy judge. And then, of course, in verse 7, back up one more step, and then I got to quit, the hindrance. All that means is somebody has brought up some data, and they're trying to compel you to believe that their understanding of the data means that God relates to people on the basis of this kind of stuff. It's called a hindrance because it's a lie. There are all kinds of ways to hinder people, but they will always start at a doctrinal level. Every hindrance that you will ever face, you will face it because you have believed something about what's valuable and what's true. And now something's coming in that is threatening something else that you consider to be valuable and true, and now you're confused, you're hindered, because this situation that's come up is a challenge to your commitment to that thing that's valuable and that thing that's true. That's how the Jews hindered the Galatians. They brought in a doctrinal concept. And granted, you can add to the doctrine, you can add force, but force really has no force without doctrine. Do you know that nobody can force you to do anything if you don't want to do it? If you don't value your life, they can threaten to take your life, and you'll say, take your best shot. Just aim good, you know. I don't want it to hurt. They'll say, okay, then I'll make you hurt. Well, okay, but I'm going to get enough grace to endure all the hurting, so just go ahead. Nobody can make you do anything if your doctrine is right and you believe it and you value what's valuable. It's only when you start valuing things that are not valuable and believing things that are not true that you become a victim of hindrance. That's what was happening to the Galatians. And that means then that the fundamental issue in verses 7 and 8, the hindrance, the persuasion that doesn't come from God, this always has to do with truth claims. And we've come full circle here, because we started out by talking about the fact that Paul said this persuasion didn't come from him who calls you. That's a truth claim. You have to deal with it. Is it true or not true? So that's the way you have to live. And the emphasis on that, verse 9, comes into the picture, but we don't have any more time, so I'm not even going to try to start there. But everything that you believe has a potential for being something that will move you into greater glory, or it will be leaven that ruins your life. Everything. So the most critical issue is being able to recognize the summons of God when God speaks, and being able to be convinced of what he's saying being true. That's how it all starts. And from there it works to our advantage if we believe what he summons us to. You can tell God no when he summons, but that means that you don't believe him. And, of course, not believing him means that you shut him out of your relationship so that he can't have that beneficial life imparting impact. I hope that wasn't too confusing. We're kind of just leaving it there because it's the beginning of the paragraph. But the Galatians did know. They did know how to run well. They just got knocked off course by hindrances. Doctrine, false teaching. Questions or comments?